Hello everyone, it's Corey here. There's no regular episode of Not Enough Champagne this week. Instead, here's a show from the archive. It's an interview I conducted with former MP and diarist Chris Mullin. It was timed to coincide with the 30th anniversary of the publication of his famous novel, A Very British Coup. It was originally broadcast on the Pod Delusion in a slightly shorter form in November 2012. Hope you enjoy it. Chris Mullin is my political hero. Announcing this is perhaps necessary in the interests of full disclosure, even if it probably does compromise any journalistic impartiality I have for this piece. Chris Mullin was MP for Sunderland from 1987 until his retirement from the House of Commons at the last election in 2010. During his time as an MP, he served as a minister in the Department of Transport and then at the Foreign Office, as well as serving as chairman of the Home Affairs Select Committee twice, from 1997 to 1999 and then from 2001 to 2003. Chris Mullin devoted most of his career to issues of injustice and civil liberties. Before becoming an MP, he produced a documentary for Granada's World in Action series, casting doubt on the convictions of the Birmingham Six pub bombers. This was expanded into a book called Error of Judgment. The end result of this campaign was the release of the innocent men in 1991, and a commission was set up, eventually leading to the establishment of the Criminal Cases Review Commission. As an MP, Chris Mullin continued to campaign on civil liberties issues, voting against New Labour's rather daft plans to detain terror suspects for 90 days without charge. He also received praise for being one of the lowest claimants during the MP's expenses scandal. Essentially, Chris Mullin is a decent man of principle, who's attracted quite a bit of notoriety over the past decade thanks to the publication of his three volumes of diaries. The Times' chief political commentator Peter Riddell said that these deserve to become the central text for understanding the Blair years. He's also written some novels, of which the most famous is A Very British Coup. This was written in 1982 and was set in 1988. A populist left-wing Labour government has just taken power, and the novel charts the attempts of the media, in collusion with the Secret Service and the Americans, to try and remove the government in a bloodless coup. There was a TV adaptation of the novel made in 1988, starring Rain McAnally as Labour Prime Minister Harry Perkins, and this was scripted by another of my favourite people ever, Alan Platter. Channel 4's current miniseries, Secret State, is also inspired by the novel. I met with Chris in Birmingham to discuss the novel 30 years on. I started by asking him what the inspiration was behind writing it.
Well, of course, it was written in 1981-2, and the political climate was very different in those days. There was a prospect of a government led by Tony Benn, which was causing panic both amongst the Labour establishment and amongst the non-Labour establishment. Cruise missiles were coming into the UK, American cruise missiles, which many people thought would make us a target rather than defend us. And they were attracting huge hostile demonstrations. And the political climate was much more volatile as well. There was speculation as to what would happen if a government led by someone like Tony Benn were to come to power and, say, try to remove the American bases, or at least the nuclear weapons in the American bases. And I was coming home from the Labour Party conference in, I think, 1980, with Peter Hain, who later became a Labour MP, Tony Banks, who later became an MP, and Stuart Holland, who was already a Member of Parliament. And we were discussing exactly this question, and Stuart said, well, he'd just tapped out the opening chapters of a novel by the swimming pool in Greece, based on exactly this proposition. And Peter Hain revealed that he and a friend had circulated an outline for a novel on exactly this subject. So I thought, goodness, I'd better get on and do this.
Try and write it quickly.
So that's how A Very British Coup came into existence. Years later, at a book club in Ipswich, I was talking about A Very British Coup, and I was approached by a man called Peter Hardiman Scott, who was the the BBC's chief political correspondent in the 1970s. He was the Nick Robinson of his day, a very famous man in his day. And in retirement, he'd been writing thrillers. And he said that when my book was published, he was two-thirds of the way through a novel based on exactly this proposition that what would happen if a left-wing government was elected. And his publisher had advised him to junk it because it was too late. Now, I was very lucky. If it had been the other way around, I was an unknown. Mm-hmm. If he did got there first, I don't think I'd ever been heard from, mm-hmm. because he was very well known.
Yes, because at that point, were you editor of Tribune at that point?
Not at that point, I wrote for Tribune, but I wasn't the editor of it. Okay. No, I was a completely obscure figure.
Okay. There were rumours of Harold Wilson being the subject of an MI5 plot. I mean, were these rumours around in the early 80s, I think?
Was it? Yes, some of them were, but events did play into my hands to make the book topical. Mm-hmm. For example, well, the first thing that happened, actually, when we published the hardback, we used to sell it through an advert at the back of Tribune.
Okay.
And the first cheque for £7.95 that came in came from the American Embassy. And so we duly packed it up and sent it off and waited to see what would happen next. And the next thing that happened was an invitation to lunch with the minister at the embassy. The minister, the most important career diplomat in the embassy. There came a day when his bulletproof Cadillac came round to Tribune's multi-story headquarters to collect me and convey me to his mansion in Kensington. And when we got there, I said, I'd assumed there'd be quite a lot of us at this lunch. But no, there was just him and me and one of his officials and a Filipino butler. And I said to him, "What on earth are you doing bothering with a minnow like me?" He said, "Well, I reckon you're among the top 1,000 opinion formers in this country." So I said, "Well, I must be about number 999. He said, "The other 999 have been here too." I didn't follow up your other points about MI5 and so forth.
Yes.
Quite a few of the things that are in the novel that are only speculation in the novel, such as, for example, I had a spy, an MI5 agent, on the Council of C&D, came to pass. That turned out to be a chap called Harry Newton, we discovered later.
Oh, right.
And he'd been an agent of MI5 for many years. He was the treasurer of C&D, so they must have had every detail. And I had a man in the BBC who was vetting senior job applications, and that turned out to be Brigadier Ronnie Stoneham. He was rumbled in 1986. He was stamping upturned Christmas trees on the personnel files of people who were not to progress. And of course, then there was Spycatcher, again in 1986, I think, when a former senior member of MI5, Peter Wright, revealed that he and a small group of colleagues had suspected that Harold Wilson was a Russian spy and had been spying on him for quite a long time, and indeed may have undertaken some activities with a view to destabilising the then Labour government.
If you were going to update the novel now, I know that Secret State is loosely based on the very British coup, but if you're going to try and sort of set this in 2012, when I suppose there's less debate now about the role of cruise missiles and about nuclear weapons here, if you were going to try and update it, I suppose, for the coalition for the internet age, have you thought about, say, who you might want to base Harry Perkins on? If not, maybe Tony Benn, is there another figure, or what issues do you think would be used in an updating of a novel?
Well, the issues would certainly be very different. There's no enormous ideological divide now. Market forces have swept all before them. Now, it's true they've come to grief with this great crisis of capitalism that we've seen in the last 3 or 4 years, so nothing is forever. But there's no one who believes in... Oh, well, that's not quite true, is it? If you'd have said a Labour government would end up nationalising 3 banks, they'd have thought you were... In 1997, they'd have said you were bonkers. So you can never tell in politics. But I think it would have to be along the lines that the new series, Secret State, which is... according to the credits, inspired by rather than based on my novel. They have very kindly paid me for the rights, and I'm immensely grateful for that. Where you've got a government up against a big multinational corporation, because it is corporations at the moment. You've seen yesterday in Parliament, they had before them 3 big multinational corporations that don't appear to be paying much or any corporation tax here. Corporation tax for many of these big multinational companies has become voluntary. And clearly that is a bit of a threat to democracy, actually. They want our markets, but they don't want to pay taxes on what they earn here.
I suppose, for, as you say, for a rather obscure left-wing political thriller, it does seem to have entered the British lexicon, doesn't it? A very British coup.
Yes, a very British coup has been in print almost continuously since 1982, when it was first published. It's had about six or seven publishers so far, and we still have trouble getting into W. H. Smith's, even with a television series, a second television series. It is not in W. H. Smith's. They just can't get their heads around it. It's extraordinary, isn't it? They've got 2,000 copies, and they've left them in a warehouse somewhere.
Is that just Smith's, or is that any of the other major books?
No, they're in every other bookshop, I think. Not in large quantities, but they're there.
I have at least the odd copy.
Yes.
That's very strange,
it's
isn't
extraordinary,
it?
Extraordinary, isn't it? Yeah. No, it's incompetence. I don't allege conspiracy. It's complete incompetence.
Yeah.
It's a Soviet-style organisation, W. H. Smith's.
I mean, when you wrote the novel, you were a quite prominent supporter of Tony Benn. I think you edited a couple of his collections of speeches. And after entering Parliament in 1987 and leaving in 2010, in that period, I suppose you sort of seemed to move from being sort of the Bennite wing of the party to being what I might call one of the more sensible sort of left-wing MPs, being quite sympathetic to Tony Blair, supporting him in 1994. What was it in those 10 or 15 years that sort of... do you think your views changed, or did your outlook change? What do you think?
On the whole, my views haven't changed. I mean, they have on some things, and clearly the Labour Party's position in 1983 on the European Union, for example, was not credible, though we now seem to swap the Tories
back
in the theatre. They were in favour of withdrawal. I think it's perfectly reasonable to ask the Americans to remove their nuclear weapons, and it's become rather more reasonable than it was in 1982 to suggest that we perhaps don't need a new generation of nuclear weapons. So I don't think that's a particularly extreme point of view, and even Tony Blair in his memoirs concedes that the decision to renew the Trident missile system was what he called an unbalanced decision. It wasn't one that was blindingly obvious, and indeed it remains not blindingly obvious to me now. So my views on any of that haven't changed. I'm sure I have mellowed to some extent, and there's nothing like losing three general elections in a row to cause one to recognise that one has to compromise with the electorate. Blair's great achievement was to drag the Labour Party, kicking and screaming, onto the centre ground of British politics and keep it there for a decade or so. And I don't think that can be taken away from him. I mean, in many respects, it all went wrong after Iraq and so forth. But up to that time, I think that he did mostly the right things.
In your diaries, I think the first chronological volume, but the third that was published, a lot of times devoted to trying to curb the influence of Rupert Murdoch on British politics. Have you therefore been interested by the events of the Leveson? Have you been sort of glued to the television watching the testimonies come in?
I haven't been glued to the television, no. I do think that the recent implosion of the News of the World and the Murdoch Empire to some extent presents us with the only opportunity in my lifetime, only realistic opportunity, to do what Harry Perkins wanted to do in the novel, and that is break up the big media conglomerates, one daily, one Sunday per proprietor, and everything else on the market. No one who owns a national newspaper should be allowed to have more than 10% ownership of a television company, and so forth. A few rules like that. You could go so far as John Major wished to go, and he was a Tory Prime Minister, and say that only EU citizens should be allowed to own more than 10% stake or whatever in our media. You asked me a moment ago what the issues would be today, and I said corporations. Well, actually, this is one that hasn't changed in the intervening 30 years.
No.
It's got rather worse, in a way, the grip of companies. It's not only Murdoch. We've now got a pornographer who owns the Daily Express and the Sunday Express and the Daily Star and the Channel 5 television. We've got a couple of tax avoiders who live on a rock in the Channel Islands owning the Daily Telegraph, which has gone sort of doolally since they got control of it. And the Sun is carrying on just like before.
One of the interesting things, I suppose, from Leveson has been what I suppose might be a temporary raising of profile of select committees. You've seen high-profile people like Tom Watson give very forensic questioning at select committee hearings. As someone who got a bit of a reputation as a forensic investigator on the select committee, is there a way of maybe capitalising on that? How do you think we can make select committees better at making Parliament more accountable?
Yes, I won't say the questioning's been all that forensic. I was present at the interview with James Murdoch. Mm. For one thing, they were calling him James all the time. Well, Mr. Murdoch is what he should be called in these circumstances. And some of them were doing a bit, including Mr. Watson, I'm sorry to say, were doing a bit of grandstanding rather than... but it's true that Tom Watson has played a very positive part in all this overall. Well, I welcome the rise of the Select Committee. People say that Parliament has got less effective. Some even go so far as to say it's all a waste of time. Now, it's quite true that the Chamber has declined as a centre of action, but it's not true of the Select Committees. And if you look only at the last few year or two, we've had the bankers paraded before the Treasury Select Committee. Yesterday we had some of the big tax avoiders before the Public Accounts Committee. And of course we've had the humbling of the great oligarch himself, Murdoch, in front of the Culture, Media and Sport Committee. And those were good moments for Parliament, I thought. I do think they need to improve the quality of the questioning. One of the difficulties a select committee faces is you've got 11 people competing to ask the questions, and some of them have got fairly mighty egos, and they're all anxious
not.
To get
MPs
their
with egos.
They're all anxious to get their little soundbite in. One way round that would it be maybe to hire a professional to on big occasions, not every day, to ask the key questions, and maybe let the MPs chip in section by section, so that there is some sort of forensic questioning. When I chaired the Home Affairs Select Committee, we had a big set too with the Chief Freemason, and I did say to the others that the only way you're going to corner this guy is if you let me ask the questions, because A, I know all about it, B, we need a consistent line of questioning, and we did, and it worked very well.
Mm-hmm. Tony Benn, when he said that he was going to, and an MP said that he was going to have more time for politics. Have you found that since 2010?
Well, interestingly, I have, yes. And that comes as quite a surprise. If you read the last volume of the diary, you'll see there's a great deal of, after I've decided to stand down, which I did 2 years before I retired, you'll see there's a great deal of agonising about whether I've made the right decision and whether there's any useful role for me in the world beyond. Mm-hmm. But the good news is that a small industry has developed around the diaries. And I spend an enormous amount of time going to literary festivals and other events, universities. Many of the invitations are prompted by the diaries. Mm-hmm. I did three last week. I spoke at Eton on Tuesday. I gave a public lecture at Sunderland University on Thursday. And I spoke at a literary festival in Leicester on Saturday. And what I've discovered is that the political meeting is not dead. Mm-hmm. It is simply transferred to the literary festival, where people pay 8, 9, 10 quid a head to come and listen, and where I get audiences of up to 700 people. Whereas if I if somebody stuck a notice on a church hall in the centre of Sunderland and said Chris Mullin will be here,
you make it 7.
By the way, it'll cost you 8 quid to get in. I don't think it would be a very large meeting.
No. I mean, did you write the diaries originally for publication? I know you started writing them about after the death of John Smith. Was that almost to try and get your own thoughts in order, or was it more with a view to publication?
Well, if I'm honest, because I'm a writer by profession, I always thought they'd be published. I always thought I'd try to get them published. I had no idea whether anybody would be interested, to be perfectly honest. Yes, publication was always likely, I think. I didn't anticipate publishing them quite as quickly as I did. I published the first volume while I was still in Parliament. I was pressed by my agent and the publishers to do that. And I thought it was too close to the events concerned. But I think they were right in terms of actually arousing some interest.
Right.
Because interest is aroused according to how close you are to the events described. So, for example, we published them out of sequence, and we published the first volume that starts with the death of John Smith and covers the rise of New Labour, as mm-hmm. it were, has only been published recently.
Mm-hmm. After they were published when you were in Parliament, I can almost see it going two ways. Either MPs know, oh, well, Chris Millen is keeping a diary, I'm not going to speak to him, or Chris Millen is keeping a diary, it'd be great to talk to him and try and get...
Well, that's very perceptive of you, because that second thing... I mean, there were one or two people who were upset regarding being quoted in the first volume, and I regret that, and I should have been more careful and anonymised some of the quotes in two or three cases. I should have done, and I do regret that. And I was more careful in the next two volumes. But yes, it was something I noticed during my last couple of years in Parliament when something interesting was happening. Far from running away from me, people would come up to me to make sure that I got their version of events. Because as you know, when a politician goes into a bookshop and looks up a political book, he always runs, the first thing he does is turn to the index and see whether his name is in there. Do you know the story about Paddy Ashdown and Don Foster?
I don't think so.
Don Foster bought a copy of Paddy Ashdown's diaries and got Paddy to sign them for him. And when Don got home, he opened the book at the index. Mm. And when he got to his name, he found that Paddy had written in the margin, "Hi, Don, I thought you'd look here first."
Do you think diaries are... I suppose you probably do have a slightly biased view on this, perhaps, but do you think diaries are almost a better way for a politician to communicate their views than the political memoir? Because the autobiographies always do seem terribly self-justificatory after the event, whereas I suppose this diary is more of a sort of living record where a politician can show himself, I suppose, to be human. It's quite interesting, I think, looking at the volume about the rise of New Labour and looking at the increasingly apocalyptic predictions for Labour in the 97 election, saying that not sure if we're going to get a majority or not. And it's the sort of thing that you can imagine being airbrushed out of a normal memoir.
So when people ask me, as they do sometimes at literary festivals, have you improved them with hindsight and cut out the things you were wrong about, I point to the fact that even a week before the 1997 general election, there are entries saying, I think we're going to lose. I mean, to be fair, I changed my mind the following day, but I could easily cut that out, but I didn't. I left it in. Yes, so it shows me warts and all, hopefully. I am a bit of a pessimist by nature, and I think a flavour of my pessimism comes through in the diaries. But that must always be a temptation. If you publish the diaries just as a way of showing what a great guy you were and how you were always right about everything, I don't think there'd be much interest. And it's true with political memoirs too. Those higher up the pecking order often tend to write about how they save the world rather than warts and all. Although I must say that a lot of the New Labour literature is, and there's been a considerable New Labour literature, memoirs, Alistair Darling, Jack Straw, Tony Blair, and some people further down the pecking order, Bob Marshall Andrews, for example. And Una King, and it's of a fairly high quality. I found most of them of interesting. There was a very good book by Jonathan Powell, who was the chief of staff in Tony Blair's office, which is called The New Machiavelli, which is also about the New Labour from the inside, and it's pretty good, I thought. On the course, there's Alistair Campbell's diaries, which are very long, but because he enjoyed total access, will be of interest to historians. I get asked to review books quite a lot by half a dozen national newspapers, which I enjoy doing, and I occasionally get to write articles in newspapers like The Times, which I'm very happy to do.
Obviously, it almost sounds like you don't have much time to write, perhaps beyond the odd book review, but have you got any more ideas for a novel?
I have got one or two ideas for a couple of other pieces of writing, not necessarily a novel, but possibly, and in due course I hope to find the time to do that. But yes, at the moment I am extremely busy, as busy as I was when I was a Member of Parliament. The other thing I want to do is grow vegetables.
And write a novel about growing vegetables, maybe?
No, I have no plans to write a novel about growing vegetables, but I have acquired a garden in Northumberland where I intend to do that.
Fantastic.
So but that's going to take a bit of time in the near future.
I think we'll leave that there. Thank you very much. That's great.
Thank you.
So you can watch both versions of A Very British Coup on Channel 4's 4OD website, and you can get the novel from all good bookshops.
apart from W.H. Smith's, it seems. Incidentally, Chris's garden was featured on Gardener's World earlier this month, so it looks like he did finally find time to grow vegetables after all. Thanks to James O'Malley for letting us use this interview, having already been on the Pod Delusion. Steve and I are back in late September for more Not Enough Champagne episodes, but there'll be another archive episode next week. So thank you for listening. See you next week. Goodbye.